would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's an opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pourizza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip marked the 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. They also expressed their anger towards the British government and its continued support to the Israeli regime. In 1917, then-British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour issued his declaration giving Zionists the permission to usurp Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration led to the displacement of the indigenous Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Hamas movement vowed to continue resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Palestinian people are still suffering from the repercussions of the ill-fated Balfour Declaration, which created a Zionist entity on holy Palestinian land. The Balfour Declaration will be trampled upon by the Palestinian people. After 104 years, we maintain that all form of resistance will be used to liberate all of the historic land of Palestine.
Palestinian refugees, who make up most of Gaza's population, demanded compensation from the British government for their pain and suffering for more than 7 decades.
We want to liberate the land of Palestine and return to the towns and villages from which we were expelled. The Zionists have no rights here and have no place in our land.
The United Kingdom, along with the United States, have been the strongest supporters of the Israeli regime. Senior Palestinian officials demanded that the British government must compensate Palestinians for the grave pain and loss.
Britain has started our misery, and the United States has taken it upon itself to continue this injustice by supporting the Zionist occupation and giving it the green light to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Both Britain and the United States have been making attempts to turn the Israeli regime into a military superpower.
104 years on, the Balfour Declaration continues to plague all aspects of life for Palestinians.
The Balfour Declaration is considered by most Palestinians as the root cause of their suffering under the Israeli occupation. They also blame England for their plight. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
People in the Gaza Strip held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross office in the Gaza Strip to express solidarity with Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who are on hunger strike in protest to their harsh conditions. 7 Palestinian inmates are in a critical condition due to their hunger strike against the illegal administrative detention practiced against them.
Palestinian inmates have resorted to hunger strike as their last means to defend their rights. Israel's illegal administrative detention must come to an end. We are here to call human rights organizations to pressurize Israel into ending the illegal policy.
In a press conference held during the demonstration, the participants warned against the deteriorating health condition of the prisoners in Israeli jails.
We are here to show our solidarity with our brothers in Israeli jails. To this end, we have gone on a hunger strike to send this message to our brothers that they are not alone in their struggle against Israel. We won't sit back and are ready to pay the price for defending our rights.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have witnessed heightened pressure over the past years. There are reportedly about 5,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, with a great number of them remaining in jail without any charge.
Supporting our inmates are among our top priorities. We feel duty-bound to defend our brothers with all possible means. To this end, we have organized a number of events to highlight the plight of Palestinian inmates inside Israeli jails.
Israeli authorities keep Palestinian inmates under harsh conditions, from lacking proper hygienic standards to systematic torture. Several Palestinian detainees have been on their hunger strike inside Israeli jails for more than 100 days, protesting their arrest with no charge and the harsh prison conditions. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have begun the hunger strike in solidarity with the prisoners, whose lives are at risk. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The 2nd of November is remembered by Palestinians as a disastrous date in history. It's the 104th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration that pledged on behalf of Britain in 1917 a homeland for the Jewish people in historic Palestine, as every year the Palestinian flag was flown at half-mast mourning this date. Palestinians say the declaration was the first official recognition of the Zionist project by a world power, leading to widespread legitimization of the cause and the eventual establishment of Israel.
Balfour Declaration was one of the worst conspiracies against the Palestinian people. It aimed at depriving us from our right to our homeland, depriving us from our right to have our state, our own state. And it has led to a very severe disaster, which is the ethnic cleansing of about 70% of the Palestinian people in 1948.
The Palestinians are demanding the United Kingdom to apologize for the declaration, and they blame Britain for helping Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. But it seems this apology won't happen, Palestinians say, as more world countries harm Palestinians, especially after former U.S. President Donald Trump invented the so-called deal of the century that envisions the Israeli annexation of large swaths of the occupied West Bank. Even after 1 year of his departure, current U.S. President Joe Biden is weak to be able to change Trump's promises to Israel.
Many colonial countries have agreed together to harm the Palestinians and their cause. But our people are still steadfast on our land and dissolve the conspiracies. Trump tried through the so-called deal of the century, first to allow Israel annex the West Bank to prevent a Palestinian state on the 1967 lines with its capital Al-Quds, and never reaching a resolution on the refugees problem. The UK helped Jewish gangs to have a stake on our land, U.S. is supporting them up until the moment.
Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration has always served as a reminder of the suffering of Palestinians during the decades of Israeli occupation, colonialism, and Judaization.
It has been over a century since the notorious Balfour Declaration. Palestinians today warn that the U.S. support of Israeli encroachment into Palestinian territory is as dangerous as Britain's Balfour Declaration and is definitely helping Israel to prolong its occupation and annex Palestinian land. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
With the socio-economic crisis deepening in Lebanon, the Saudi regime is not making things any easier. Riyadh's reaction to comments by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi, who had decried the Saudi war on Yemen, is a stick being used against the Lebanese government. The main question is, will he step down?
Concerning Mr. Kordahi, it is obvious now that he is not going to resign because he is not resembling himself. He is resembling a huge national bloc that is backing him because it's a matter of the Lebanese dignity here. We are not going to let the Saudis succeed in their blackmailing moves against Lebanon.
But analysts believe the Saudi Crown Prince is trying to get concessions from Lebanon in return for funding the economic reform plan.
Saudi Crown Prince is trying to make use of the economic crisis taking place in Lebanon to put pressure on the Lebanese to make some concessions regarding his influence inside Lebanon. And here there is some kind of intersection between the Saudis and the Israelis, because the target is the resistance in Lebanon.
Lebanese Foreign Minister Abdullah Abu Habib told Agence France-Presse that he had invited the Saudis to the negotiating table in a bid to solve all the outstanding problems. Saudi Arabia is an Arab country, he said, which has historic brotherly ties with Lebanon, but then severed diplomatic ties without holding any talks. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati is also holding talks with other Arab states in COP20 in Glasgow to see whether the diplomatic row can be eased. Now, observers say it all has to do with how the Americans deal with the Saudis.
The main issue is between Riyadh and Washington. Once the situation between Washington and Riyadh is solved, I think the crisis will be solved in Lebanon. And the pressure the Saudis are exerting on Lebanon is going to soften. But up till now, it seems that Mikati having the backing of Washington and Paris, because, as I said, they both want this government to remain.
While the crisis resulting from Minister Kordahi's statements remains high, the Saudis themselves have declared that their campaign against Lebanon is a much bigger issue. Their ultimate goal in the last couple of decades seemed to have been detaching Hezbollah from the Lebanese political scene. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
As Afghanistan is struggling with a wide range of problems, the country's officials warn against the plots hatched by Afghanistan's enemies to wreak further havoc on it. In a conference in the capital, Kabul, Taliban's acting minister of enjoining good and forbidding wrong said that discord has been a big threat to Muslim world even from the very beginning of Islam, adding that one of Afghanistan invaders' goals has been to sow sedition among different Muslim sects in the country.
During the invasion years, the enemies did whatever they wanted in our country. One of their goals was to deepen the differences among our people. This conspiracy has always been used against Muslims throughout history. And if we don't remain united, our enemies will again take control of Afghanistan.
During the conference, Muslim scholars stressed the need for solidarity and tolerance. They added that if Muslims stay aware and united, no one can invade their soil or they don't need to beg foreigners.
Muslim unity should not remain in slogans. People and nations should practically implement it. Islamic governments are obliged to bring Muslims together. Today's critical situation in our country is deeply rooted in the discord created by the Western countries.
We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime are trying to weaken Muslims. Westerners are afraid of the spread of Islam. To stop its progress, they have already hatched various plots, including the formation of Takfiri groups.
After taking power, the Taliban reached to different groups and ethnicities and assured them of protecting their rights and providing a safe haven for all Afghans. But as observers say, it remains to be seen what the future holds for the country. Muslim scholars hope that the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan paves the way for solidarity and tolerance in the country. At the same time, they warn of divisive plot by Islam's enemies. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Last week, the Biden administration said that it is considering giving $450,000 per person to immigrants separated at the border. However, there are still 1,727 children yet to be reunited with their families, representing 33% of all those identified as separated from their parents by DHS under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, a clear violation of human rights.
Essentially due to the racism on the part of the United States and how they resolve the problem. So, for example, the border crisis from Canada is very differently handled than the one that happens from the U.S.-Mexico border. And there's also this lack of dignity rights that are afforded those who are from the global south in terms of how they want to seek entry into the United States.
Many experts agree that the United States has failed to help Latin American countries to have strong, transparent public institutions with less corruption. Another problem is that some Central American countries have the highest rates of poverty and violence in Latin America, which requires greater investment to create jobs and combat gangs that terrorize Central Americans who end up fleeing to the U.S.
I believe what hinders that relations of the United States with their southern neighbors is a history of bad relations, right? Even if you want to build on good relations now, relations that better the conditions in those countries so that these people do not need to emigrate from their countries.
More than 60% of immigrants have resided in this country for more than a decade and have more than 4 million children born in the United States. Despite all discriminations and difficulties imposed by different governments, they are the backbone of the agriculture, construction, and hospitality sectors, representing 5% of the workforce. If the promises of the United States to make more than three times as many people as full citizens comes to fruition, this could be open the door to one of the most important demographic changes in modern American history. By pulling millions of Latin immigrants out of the shadows and as potential voters. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Curvello.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
We have an urgent matter, namely coronavirus and the issue of health. This has turned into an urgent matter that should be dealt with. Of course, the previous administration made good efforts in the area of health. They carried out good tasks and followed up the matter. They both worked on the production of vaccines inside the country and on the importation of vaccines. There are some rumours here and there, most of which are not true. Good things were done. These measures should be pursued and insisted on. Treatment, preventative measures, healthcare and testing. Testing the possibly infected patients is very important, should receive attention. These issues should definitely be dealt with. Public vaccination is a very important issue which should definitely be carried out. Another issue is imposing a smart lockdown.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I have heard that some Western countries, which have managed to control their infection rates and whose death and infection rates are lower than ours, have closed their borders in a way that they do not even allow the people in their neighboring country, which is also a developed country, but whose rate of infection is high, to come visit their country. In other words, they are careful. We should be really careful about controlling our borders and about preventing the new variants of this disease or other diseases from entering the country, because this is a very important matter. Of course, the people have certain responsibilities as well. As I have frequently said before, our dear people should undertake these four important responsibilities. One is wearing a mask, another is observing social distancing, the third is using good ventilation systems, and the last one is washing hands with soap. These are not difficult tasks. They are all easy. If they observe these, it will definitely be effective in reducing infection, and the high figures of death that ache one's heart will not occur.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The U.S. State Department has approved its first major arms sale to Saudi Arabia under U.S. President Joe Biden, with a sale of 280 air-to-air missiles valued as much as $650 million. On Thursday, the Pentagon notified Congress of the sale, which the State Department had approved in October. This comes amid harsh criticism against Saudi Arabia for its military onslaught on Yemen. The kingdom, backed by the U.S. and regional allies, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing the government of former Yemeni President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi back to power and battling the Ansarullah movement. The war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more, destroying Yemen's infrastructure and creating an unprecedented humanitarian crisis. Well, joining us on this spotlight, we have journalist of the Gray Zone News, Ben Norton, who's joining us from Washington, D.C., and also Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, who's with us from Detroit.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Norton in Washington. The United States has approved a potential weapons sale worth $650 million to Saudi Arabia. This is seen as the first major military sale to Riyadh under President Joe Biden. Give us your views on the deal.
Well, it's a clear sign that when the Biden administration claimed as it entered office it would end the war in Yemen, we've seen the exact opposite. We've actually seen an escalation of the war in Yemen, and especially right now with an intensification of fighting, it looks more and more like the Yemeni people are going to win this war, and the puppet regime that was installed by the United States and Saudi Arabia in the south of the country is losing ground, and this seems like yet another desperate tactic to try to beefing up the Saudi military as it tries to continue to prop up this illegitimate, unpopular government in the south of Yemen. And I want to remind viewers that when Joe Biden came into office, he claimed that he was going to end the war in Yemen. But if you listen to the speech he gave, the way it was portrayed and by many legacy media outlets is they claimed that he was ending the war in Yemen. But actually what Biden said is that Washington was ending its support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, but would continue supporting so-called defensive operations by Saudi Arabia in the war in Yemen. Now, for a lot of us, that was a pretty striking comment, because from the very beginning, this war has never been defensive. Saudi Arabia is the one that in March 2015 began bombing its southern neighbor. It has always been an offensive war by definition, and this is yet another example of the Biden administration, and specifically the Antony Blinken State Department, and Antony Blinken in the Obama administration helped oversee the beginning of the war in Yemen way back in 2015. This is yet another example of them violating their promises. They claimed they were going to end this war in Yemen after 6 years, but in many ways they're actually not only continuing it, but escalating it further.
Saeed Khan, those comments that Mr. Norton mentioned earlier in the year, U.S. President Biden, Joe Biden, he announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. Less than a year, those comments didn't age well, did they?
Well, I think it shows meet the new boss, same as the old boss, and in many ways, the boss is really not the administration's. Washington is now surrounded by the headquarters or the branches of defense companies. And clearly what we see here is that irrespective of what might have been any stated intention, reality sets in for any incoming administration as to who's really calling, pardon the pun, the shots. And here we find then another golden opportunity for the United States to seemingly do what it does best when it comes to foreign policy, and that is engage in military contracts. And I think it's rather fitting and timely as to when this is happening. The price of oil has gone up, which means, of course, that the Saudis and other purchasers of U.S. weapons have the cash to spend on it. And if we want to get even more cynical than that, we can say that the Chinese, of course, are highly dependent on oil. They are paying now for that oil. And as a result, that money then finds its way back into the coffers, not of the U.S. Treasury, but into the coffers of U.S. Defense contractor companies. It is a rather cynical approach, but I think that this revolving door image and mechanism is perhaps most indicative of what we've seen in the United States, and particularly in Washington now for several decades.
Mr. Norton, Joe Biden said in his speech at the State Department the comments that you were also alluding to earlier in the year, the war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. There were hopes of seeing a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one maybe with less bombs and more actual diplomacy and aid. It seems administrations may change, but some policies are set in stone.
As the other guest pointed out, the crucial detail in this is the role of the military-industrial complex. We need to remember that both parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, are very consistently funded by these weapons contractors, and especially in areas in Northern Virginia and parts of Maryland. They are key contributors to the campaigns of both Republicans and Democrats, and the Biden administration is absolutely no exception. Biden himself is no exception. And I also think that we should see the situation on the ground in Yemen and the region as a whole. I think that's one of the motivating factors. It's not just enriching these weapons corporations. That's certainly part of it. But also the Saudi, that is the U.S.-Saudi forces in Yemen have been losing the war. There's been fighting going on for the major city of Madib, and it looks very likely that the Houthi movement, Ansar Allah, the resistance of the Yemeni people, is going to win. And they've been consistently winning this war despite years of brutal bombing backed by Saudi Arabia is increasingly desperate. And we can see this further in Saudi Arabia's very strange, chaotic policy across the region, for instance, basically kind of declaring war on Lebanon and meddling extensively in Lebanon right now. And we see that absolutely supported. The Biden administration, for opportunistic reasons, claiming to support, it kind of superficially criticized Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia has been a loyal U.S. asset going back until Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, the great progressive president, supposedly. He met with the king, Ibn Saud, in 1945 in February and pledged that Washington would prop up the Saudi monarchy in return for Saudi Arabia maintaining stability in the global oil market. So we have seen for many decades this bipartisan consistency, and Joe Biden himself never inspired any confidence. He himself gave a speech to donors, wealthy donors in New York before the election, in which he pledged that nothing would fundamentally change. And in terms of foreign policy, nothing has fundamentally changed. This war in Yemen, which began under Obama and was accelerated under Donald Trump, is being continued under Biden.
Mr. Khan, let's not forget the major humanitarian crisis that the likes of the United States has helped aggravate in Yemen. Earlier in the year, over 300 anti-war and humanitarian organizations across the world, they highlighted Western countries' role as enablers of Saudi crimes in Yemen. Not only were these countries complacent, but they were complicit in the crimes committed in Yemen. Tell us more about that.
Well, hardly a surprise, given that most of these Western countries have blood on their hands from their own colonial projects dating back to starting in the 16th century and moving forward. Looking at Yemen again as being a killing field has occurred even in the 1960s with the staged Yemen war between various forces, including Saudi Arabia and Great Britain at that time. Unfortunately, the problem is that the United States is not getting out of the way for the kind of humanitarian aid that needs to come into Yemen and to rebuild the country. Unless and until the United States is able to finally wean itself not only of its own appetite for continuing this, but also giving shelter and cover to its regional allies in the region when it comes to Saudi Arabia and others, I'm afraid that the situation for Yemen remains dire. And I think that point that Mr. Norton made regarding the rather tepid response from Congress, despite the kind of rhetoric that the Biden administration had provided early on, despite the statements of the United States holding Saudi Arabia account for the Khashoggi murder, despite the release of the 9/11 report, albeit still redacted, about Saudi involvement on that day. None of these seem to shake the rather implacable relationship that, as Mr. Norton said, really goes back to the very inception of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States, which again, if I may just make a slight deviation, although FDR did meet with Ibn Saud in the Great Bitter Lake after FDR was coming back from Yalta, and of course prior to his death just weeks later, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States was forged between Ibn Saud and Standard Oil Company. That, I think, tells everything that needs to be understood as to why the relationship is still the way that it is between these two countries.
And Mr. Norton, let's go back a little more on the campaign trail. Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, looking at today, the Saudis, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. How do you see those comments?
It was, of course, rhetoric. What's interesting is that Donald Trump so wholeheartedly embraced the Saudi monarchy that It did a lot of damage to the image of U.S.-Saudi relations. It was associated strongly with the Trump camp, with the Republican Party. So Democrats, for cynical, opportunistic reasons, pretended to oppose Saudi Arabia. There's also a conflict going on, a geopolitical conflict, where Saudi Arabia has been trying to improve its relations with Russia, and there's discussions of Saudi Arabia buying potential Russian military technology. So the U.S. is trying to discipline Saudi Arabia, this country that Washington thinks should always follow orders, because Washington's foreign policy says that every country around the world should follow its orders. But at the end of the day, we see that when Joe Biden might lightly criticize Saudi Arabia, it's purely rhetorical, because what's most important to Saudi Arabia is that the U.S. government will continue selling it weapons. And more importantly, I mean, the weapons are important, but also the U.S. military has been directly aiding the Saudi military. Let's not forget, the Saudi military has very little experience waging war. And we have known for many years, since the beginning of the war in Yemen in March 2015, that the U.S. military and the British military have had military personnel physically on the ground in Riyadh, in command centers, providing assistance. They have a list of, with access to all of the targets in Yemen, and they, in some cases, actually are directly approving Saudi Arabia's airstrikes in Yemen. And I want to remind our viewers that those airstrikes in Yemen have consistently, intentionally targeted civilian areas in Yemen. We know, for instance, that over one-third of Saudi air raids have hit civilian targets in Yemen, and specifically food production. Saudi Arabia, with the total support of Washington and London, has intentionally tried to destroy food production in Yemen, trying to create a famine, trying to use hunger and starvation as a weapon to try to break the will of the Yemeni people and to try to retake the north of the country where the majority of Yemenis live. And this is a policy, again, that I want to stress, has been consistent and bipartisan throughout the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration.
Saeed Khan, what is Washington gaining from this war being dragged out for so long? Many believe that if Riyadh didn't have the green light from the U.S., this war would have been over by now.
I think Mr. Norton addressed that very articulately in saying that this is leverage. We are finding geopolitical shifts that are underway. The Middle East is no longer the unilateral playground for the United States to assert its will. The entry of both China, particularly with its long-term infrastructure and investments with Iran, $400 billion over 25 years. The unprecedented penetration of Russia into the region, something not even really seen during the Cold War, means that the neighborhood has gotten a bit more crowded. We also have then this kind of equivocation that is being detected, as Mr. Norton said, regarding the Saudis perhaps seeking weapons elsewhere, including from Moscow. As a result of it, the United States feels as though it needs to up its game to, in fact, remain in the game in the way that it operates with Saudi Arabia. And so the best way that it can probably develop and nurture that relationship is essentially turning a blind eye to what Riyadh's policies are within Yemen. I am sure that Riyadh is saying, look, this is our neighborhood issue, something that the U.S. doesn't want to then find itself getting embroiled into. The U.S. hasn't exactly had a very strong winning record or percentage in the Middle East of late. And as a result, when it comes to some of the humanitarian atrocities that we find and asking the question about whether Saudi Arabia will be held accountable for this, I think that that's a question that also could be asked of the United States when it comes to Afghanistan and whether it would be held accountable for very many similar civilian atrocities that have occurred there.
Ben Norton, we've been focusing on why this war is continuing. Let's look at this from another vantage point. What has to happen for the international community, the UN at its helm, to put a halt to this war? How many more weddings and schools and hospitals and residential districts have to be attacked and have to be destroyed before there is tangible action to stop this asymmetrical war, the asymmetrical attacks that are being carried out by the Saudi-led coalition against Yemenis?
Well, there need to be peace negotiations, and Riyadh needs to accept the fact that it does not control Yemen, that the Yemeni people are sovereign, and that the majority of Yemeni people live in areas governed. You'll hear the media say controlled, but rather governed by Ansar Allah and its allies. And they have created a representative government. It's not just members of the Houthi movement that are in that government. It's a representative government. And Saudi Arabia refuses to tolerate that. And that's a violation of the sovereignty of the Yemeni people. I think there have been in the past, in recent years, there have been some attempts that provided a glimmer of hope for a potential peace breakthrough in negotiations. But I do want to remind our viewers that Washington has consistently played a role putting its foot on the scale to sabotage those peace negotiations. And the most egregious example of this is when the U.S. government carried out a blatant act of war or state terrorism, murdering one of the top Iranian government officials, Qasem Soleimani, and also one of the top Iraqi military officials, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. And I want to remind viewers that when the Trump administration ordered those drone strikes in January, murdering those top Iranian and Iraqi officials, it was also an attempt to sabotage peace negotiations that were going on. This was a clear sign of the United States that it opposed peace negotiations going on in the region. So when you have a superpower, the leading empire in the world, the most powerful empire, going out of its way to sabotage peace talks, it's very difficult to have that kind of diplomatic breakthrough that we need.
And very briefly, if you may, Mr. Saeed Khan, how does this war end?
I don't know if it will end, and I apologize for sounding so pessimistic closing the show. The fact is that there does not seem to be any will for those who are most in a position to end this war to have the appetite or the intentionality to do so.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Journalist at the Gray Zone News, Ben Norton, joining us from Washington, and Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University, Saeed Khan, joining us from Detroit. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and comments with us here on Spotlight, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's program. It's good night for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. To reduce building sector emissions and improve health and well-being, there is no more important place to start than the home. We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Cosima Starr and Rebecca Ochong. The piece is titled "Housing Buildings Are Key to Sustainable Development." The article has been published by the Asia Times. In the transition to a low-carbon, resilient and sustainable society and economy, buildings and construction activities play a critical role as they are the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. As a matter of fact, they're responsible for more than 38% of global energy-related carbon dioxide emissions, higher than any other sector. To tackle buildings' emissions and pressing housing issues holistically, it is important to think and act across sectors and engage with all stakeholders. Pressing challenges like climate change, housing for all, environmental degradation, and health cannot be tackled one by one and in silos, but rather need to be approached in an integrated manner. This multi-solving is what sustainable consumption and production, or SCP, one of the keystones of the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, stand for. At the fully virtual 8th Asia-Pacific Housing Forum, funded Switch Asia SCP Facility and Habitat for Humanity, taking place from 7th to 9th of December 2021, discussions among multiple sector stakeholders will be brought forward. The Housing Forum, with the theme Building Forward Better for Inclusive Housing, highlights the urgent need for building sustainable, affordable housing through inclusive approaches. Many developing countries must deal with the challenges of making adequate housing available, as well as climate change mitigation and adaptation in their building sectors. When carefully planned, mitigation and adaptation strategies for buildings not only can stimulate the growth of new businesses and jobs, but can also contribute to other development goals such as clean air, healthy environment, access to clean energy and clean water, and making cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. Among critical elements that deserves particular attention is the social dimension, as it is in housing that social inequalities are felt most deeply. Social inequalities have been evident during COVID-19 lockdowns, when the most vulnerable could not safely shelter in place because of a lack of decent, safe, adequate, and affordable housing. When we talk about housing and health, no one should be left behind. That means tackling all the barriers in what we call the housing ecosystem. The housing ecosystem is composed by all the social norms, formal and informal institutions, and trends and events that influence how people act to make changes that they value in their housing situations. At the center of the housing ecosystem are people with their capabilities, vulnerabilities, voices, and influence. They are the ones who will make changes around their housing situations and who will define and realize the ways to improve their lives. Some Asian governments have already made commitments to provide adequate housing to all. This means homes that need to be affordable, safe and secure, and provide healthy living spaces, comfortable in terms of temperature, light, noise level, and indoor air quality. This ambition should be the starting point for any intervention on reducing emissions. In its regional roadmap for buildings and construction in Asia, the Global Alliance for Building and Construction lays out the many benefits arising from tackling the climate change holistically, by putting human needs at the center, considering resulting social, economic, and health benefits. For example, improving access to clean energy not only solidifies climate commitments, but also leads to health benefits and poverty alleviation, as air pollution is reduced and employment is created. Community-based micro-entrepreneurs are needed to build and service decentralized renewable energy installations. The health impacts of switching to clean energy and green buildings are real. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that around 7 million people die every year from air pollution. Buildings and household air pollution can significantly increase the risk of both communicable and non-communicable diseases, including cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, pneumonia, stroke, and lung cancer. A holistic approach that puts human needs at the center is championed by the uptake of SCP practices. These encourage us to see all sectors as part of a human-built system that can and needs to be changed when joint societal goals such as those formulated in the SDGs or the Paris Climate Accord are not being met. For example, updating building codes to integrate sustainability and climate change can also integrate mandates for non-toxic building materials, as well as standards for thermal comfort, light, noise, and indoor air quality, thereby preventing diseases and improving residents' well-being. All stakeholders must be involved to improve the climate impacts of a sector, and any intervention needs to consider its wide-ranging negative and positive impacts. This is particularly important for policymakers. While climate commitments may be long-term and made at the international level, developing solutions that are meaningful for living conditions and quality of life are immediate and highly local. Since 2007, a program has implemented 15 grant projects contributing to sustainable housing in South, Southeast, and East Asia. The program is also providing technical assistance to Pakistan on developing a green building code and to Kyrgyzstan on promoting energy efficiency in the construction sector. The Switch Asia Switch Off Air Pollution project, implemented in Mongolia, offers a practical example of how building and ensuring access to sustainable and healthy homes can improve public health outcomes, reduce inequalities, mitigate carbon, and improve urban sustainability and resilience. To respond to the increasing levels of toxic air pollution in Ulaanbaatar, the world's coldest capital city, Switch Asia was initiated in 2018 to promote energy efficiency in Mongolia's housing sector. The project is working to increase community awareness on the importance of insulation and its benefits by promoting a step-by-step approach. This has been done by developing an affordable building retrofit of varying cost and efficiency for households based on the needs and financial capacity of individual families. Soap retrofitting solutions can save families up to 70% of energy costs if fully implemented. The benefits of these solutions include improved health, increased energy efficiency and increased comfort, extra savings from heating, and reduced workload from coal burning. Working towards these objectives, the project's team is active on the ground, connecting households with local construction workers, qualified suppliers, and green loans from financial institutions through a standardized delivery model that ensures the quality of the implementation and sustainability of the market mechanism. Capacity building of stakeholders of the delivery model is ensured continuously. Furthermore, the developed technical procedures of the project are included in the construction codes and standards of buildings, envelope, thermal insulation of Mongolia.